Our nation's founders gathered in taverns to enjoy lively conversation over a local brew, and so do we. It's a special Pints and Politics edition of River to River, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer.
And I'm Aaron Jordan. A supersized political panel tonight. Our regulars are Todd Dorman, Gazette Insights and Opinion Editor, Althea Cole, Gazette Columnist, and Tom Barton, Deputy Des Moines Bureau Editor. Our special guests are Adam Sullivan, former Gazette Columnist, and Liam Hallowith, Political Editor of the Daily Iowan at the University of Iowa.
And we're so happy to be here at Big Grove in Cedar Rapids. What a wonderful venue for us. Aaron, start us off.
All right. President Joe Biden this week signed a bill providing $95 billion in aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. And this was a show of bipartisan cooperation after a lot of fighting about it. But far-right Republicans did not want this bill to pass. Todd, how do you expect this to affect House Speaker Mike Johnson?
Well, you know, I suppose it might jeopardize his job, but I think probably the main effect is that he's now, you know, in this instance, he's seen as someone that can get something done, brought the parties together, he passed something in the House that obviously a majority of House members wanted. He needed Democrats to help him with that, which hasn't been unusual because when they've run up against budget or government shutdowns and things, he's also, Republican speakers have had to turn to Democrats. That's how Kevin McCarthy lost his job. But I'm not sure if Republicans have the stomach to go through another multi-ballot speaker election. I think it's one of those things where there's a streak in the Republican Party where they're not for Ukraine aid. I guess at the most extreme, you could say they're puppeting some Russian propaganda. There's a streak in the Republican Party that admires authoritarian leaders like Viktor Orban in Hungary and to some extent Putin. Certainly Donald Trump likes Putin. So I think a lot of that has come together to sort of build a section of the party who is against helping Ukraine. They're loud and they're when you've only got a couple few seats, you know, in your majority, those members will matter.
Speaker Johnson evidently changed his tune quite significantly here from when he was a rank and file member of the House to being the House leader, according to reports. His mind was changed by some of the highest level intelligence briefings he was given here too. And so I want to ask a little bit about American attitudes on this type of foreign aid for Ukraine, for Israel, for the Indo-Pacific, and also humanitarian aid here, also for Gaza. I'd like to turn to Liam there as the political editor at the Daily Iowan, because as you can see looking out here, we have not a lot of your age category, Liam. So I want to tap you for what you sense as the 20-something attitude towards this amount of foreign aid going for these purposes for this war.
Well, I think it's very important to know that the majority of young Americans aren't deciding who to vote for based on foreign aid. You know, I think they're mostly more motivated by social issues and things like that. But I think it does tend to fall down party lines where, you know, Republicans, certainly a certain subset of young Republicans, don't support aid. You know, some of the more conservative members on our campus, Jasmine Jordan has been very not very happy about, you know, the amount of aid given to these foreign countries. But, you know, certainly a lot of mainstream Republicans on campus do support it. So I think when it comes to kind of the younger subsect of, you know, the political parties, they kind of fall in line with party norms on this. But I don't think it's going to be a deciding factor for a lot of younger voters.
This bill also promises to ban TikTok in the U.S. if Chinese firm ByteDance doesn't sell the app within 9 months. Again, I was going to fall on you, Liam. You know, if you could just express how important the use of TikTok is to Americans and what What do you hear from students about a possible ban?
I think the majority of students probably don't support a ban. There's not a lot of polling, specifically on the University of Iowa campus, but there's some polling by Pew Research that shows that since March 2023 to about a December 2023 poll, the majority of young and adult Americans, you know, their support for a ban has decreased over time. But I think, you know, the majority of young Americans do have TikTok. I think they're probably the biggest share of the voting population that has TikTok. I can't say whether this will be a deciding factor when it comes to November. You know, obviously, both Trump and Biden have expressed, you know, distaste for Chinese ownership of TikTok. But I think that the majority of young Americans are now paying attention to this issue more because, you know, all of them could now have not have access to that app. So I think, I don't know if it'll be a deciding factor come November, but I do think it'll be in, you know, young voters' minds.
Iowa's congressional delegates, especially Representative Ashley Hinson, have been vocal about the Chinese government's ability to spy on Americans through the TikTok app and control the algorithm to manipulate users. I mean, it doesn't sound like that has actually happened, but given some past incidents like the Chinese spy balloon, how reasonable is it for Congress to be concerned about this? Althea, I don't know, or Adam, if you have any thoughts about, you know, is this a legitimate concern?
I think there are a lot of concerns with TikTok, the data privacy, the potential to influence things, but I think those things are also true of the American government and American-based companies. So I'm really skeptical of this. I think it's probably unconstitutional. I don't think it will get implemented, which I think is good because the users of this platform, Americans have rights to use products like this, but B, like foreigners and companies also have constitutional rights. And so like this sets a really bad precedent for like singling out specific companies. And to target out a place or a business in part because that's where people go to discuss politics, that's one of the concerns is that, you know, kids' views of politics are getting warped by this app. But for Congress to say this platform for discussing politics is illegal is, I mean, that's just extremely troublesome to me.
I would not put it past the Chinese government to do anything of the spying sort. And if it was somehow found constitutional for the United States government to ban the app, it would have to be under their right and responsibility of national defense, because otherwise, how would you get away with it? But even if for some reason they were able to get away with banning TikTok, it doesn't change the fact that there are so many other social media companies. To Adam's point, American companies, you know, are just as good at collecting information and wielding it against us. Facebook knows that I'm a huge Cyclone fan. Facebook knows that I like funny videos of cats. Facebook knows probably a lot of other stuff about me. All I ever remember giving them is my email address and a few of other pieces of information, but everything I put on my Facebook as far as, you know, whoa, what my day was like, or, you know, picture of this or something like that, that's all our personal data that we're putting out there proactively. Nobody's making us do it.
We've touched on the foreign aid for Ukraine. That has divided the Republican Party in this country to some extent. Let's move to an issue that has divided the Democratic Party, namely the college protests over the Israel-Gaza war continuing to spread across the country, also here in the Midwest. I think a lot of reports coming out of the University of Minnesota, but other places in the Midwest as well. So this prompts me to ask, first of all, of our audience here in your long lives, how many of you clap if you have participated in a public protest? Okay. People who have demonstrated their disagreement in the form of public protest. Let's talk about where we are now. Where is the line between allowing free speech and making sure our campuses are safe, which seems to be a central question that has been asked again and again in the past few weeks of these campus protests? Who would like to jump in there?
I think these issues are really messy. Like, it's not always clear what the line is, but when you're going to the point of disrupting other people from what they want to do, I think that does cross the line. I would also just challenge everyone to think about, like, if it's somebody with some other viewpoint doing this, you know, maybe you don't agree with this protest, or maybe you do, maybe you did agree with other past protests and maybe you didn't, and just challenge yourself, like, are you objecting to the issue at hand, or are you objecting to this form of protest, because I think, you know, certainly in the government's eyes, that should be, you know, viewpoint neutral. But I think often, like, our knee-jerk reactions to that stuff is very painted by, you know, how we feel about the underlying issue.
Having attended a lot of protests, especially over the last year, or I should say events that have received protests, I can't help but point out that nobody has ever gone to an event, seen protesters there who ended up disrupting the event quite significantly, and thought, oh, I have just changed my mind on everything now. So the question I always ask myself is, are they here really to share a different point of view, or are these protesters just here to, you know, raise hell? Unfortunately, a lot of the times anymore, it's the latter.
At the same time, Althea, we can't deny that it seems that the Democratic Party, led by the current president, has shifted his position on Israel and Gaza because of the large section of his party that is protesting Israel's actions here, can we?
You cannot deny that, definitely. No. Biden is scared of losing
the young person's vote. So, I mean, to the effectiveness of the protests, you were sort of asking, what are the people out there for? And it seems to me they've had quite an impact on the Democratic Party and showing a split between some members and other members of the party.
So the question would be then, how much of the reduction in support from young people for President Biden leading up to the re-election is specifically related to the protests or the overall Israel/Gaza issue? I'm not sure it's entirely related to that, but you still make a very good point.
I think we're seeing not only the Biden administration, we're starting to see sort of a world consensus by countries that would normally be in support of Israel saying, you know, we think you maybe have gone too far and need to back off and quit killing so many civilians. So that's, if the protests help with that, fine, but I think it's, you know, a lot of dangerous reporting on the ground that's also brought us some of that information.
You're listening to a special Pints and Politics edition of River to River from IPR News in partnership with the Gazette, recorded yesterday evening, April 25th, at Big Grove in Cedar Rapids. We'll be back in just a moment with more. It's a special Pints and Politics edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Yesterday evening, we gathered in Cedar Rapids at Big Grove before a live audience. Our panelists, Gazette journalists Todd Dorman, Althea Cole, and Tom Barton. Also, Adam Sullivan and Liam Hollowith. Aaron Jordan was my co-host. Let's get back to the discussion.
Daily Show host Jon Stewart criticized some news outlets for too much reporting on things like Trump's route to the courthouse. What is the appropriate level of interest Americans should have in these proceedings? What are the stakes for Trump? I don't know, Adam, if you want to hit on that.
I think there's a longstanding argument, or, you know, since the Trump era began, that, like, this continuous coverage, you know, to some extent fuels his popularity and fuels his rise. I think there's something to that, but of all the cases that Trump is facing right now, which it's really hard to keep track of, I think these New York cases are the least important, the least consequential. I think they're the ones that lend the most credibility to Trump's claim that this is a political witch hunt. They really went out of their way to bring excessive charges for stuff that other people probably would not have been charged with. And my understanding is some of them are kind of novel legal theories, that it's not clear that you can charge people with this kind of stuff. I think we should be much more concerned with, like, the Supreme Court case going on right now, where Trump is basically claiming that he has immunity, that if he's not, since he wasn't ever removed from office by the Senate in his impeachment trials, that he can't be convicted of those crimes that he was tried for by Congress. Whichever side you're on with that, I have mixed feelings about it, honestly. I mean, obviously, I think he's wrong about the law, but the idea of prosecuting former presidents is just going to get into a really messy arms race. So I'm uneasy about it, but that seems much more important to me than, the financial crimes, supposed financial crimes he faces in New York. So I don't think, I mean, people who watch cable news maybe care about his car ride to the courthouse, and that's what they're doing it for viewers, but I don't think it's important.
As long as this trial lasts in Manhattan, we'll have 4 days where he is suspending in the courtroom and have this sort of split screen experience between Trump in the courtroom, outside the courtroom. And also campaigning here. I wonder, what are your thoughts now that the first criminal trial is underway, and perhaps this will be the only trial that happens before the general election? We've seen in recent polls a meaningful share of current Trump supporters say they would be less likely to vote for him if he were convicted of a crime. In the coming months, do you see anything so far that might derail Donald Trump's third bid for the White House? Remember, he hasn't been officially nominated by his party.
Isn't he like almost 80?
80 years old, 77, I believe.
I can think of a few things that could derail him. I mean, I don't, both of these guys, right? Like they're, anything could happen. I don't know. The legal stuff, I don't think, I mean, the idea that he would be incarcerated or anything before the trial, I think most people agree is unlikely. He might theoretically face incarceration at some point, but if he's the president, that gets tricky. But no, I don't think these legal issues really trip him up much. I think they, I think if anything, it's a turnout tool for his side.
Yeah, I don't. You know, I understand the risk of overcovering, overexposing Donald Trump. But I mean, just basically as a journalist, and I mean my basic tenet is that these trials should be televised, that we should be able to see what's happening. I think that's, because everything is, I mean, it's easy for people to dismiss stuff because it's all reporters reporting on transcripts and things. I think if people would got to see the trials, that might have a different effect than just, you know, Trump versus the prosecutors versus the media.
A Quinnipiac University poll released this week showed 66% of Americans support legalized abortion, which is the highest level in two decades of the university's polling. Support for legal abortion in all cases is 34%, a near record high, and support for abortion being illegal in all cases is at a record low of 5%. How do you expect this subject will arise in the 2024 presidential election, where Biden and Trump are in a dead heat?
Well, I mean, I think we're already starting to see that this is going to be a key issue for the Biden campaign and for Democrats in general. They are already running hard on this issue. I can't remember how long ago, but just, you know, a couple of months ago, you had Vice President Kamala Harris visiting a Planned Parenthood center or a clinic in Minnesota. So, I mean, this is definitely an issue that they are going to be hammering on between now and November, and talking about the ramifications and potential unintended consequences of Republican-led states pursuing further abortion restrictions, and what that means for IVF and for families that are relying on these fertility treatments and you know, going through the family planning process. And again, the potential unintended consequences, like we saw in Alabama with that state's Supreme Court ruling, and how you apply definitions of personhood, unborn person, and again, implications that has for people, undergoing IVF treatments and access to birth control as well. That is going to be a key issue in the upcoming election, not just the presidential election. We're also seeing it in congressional races. You're going to see it in state house races. When you already were told by Jennifer Converse, the leader of House Democrats, that this is an issue that they are going to run on hard. You're going to be seeing a lot of ads, billboards, and probably already have, and it's just going to intensify.
Well, I think you're going to see Republicans sort of try their best to de-emphasize the issue, talk a lot about services for mothers, talk about the exemptions that they want to put in these laws. Although, you talk to doctors, they'll tell you that it's really tough to say, to declare that someone's life is in danger. At what point do you do that without being taken before the medical board and losing your license? I mean, so they're gonna try to de-emphasize it and talk about other things kind of on the fringes of that. I don't think that's gonna be terribly successful, but I also don't know, especially in Iowa, how many people are gonna you know, that issue is going to decide their vote.
I'm not sure either. I mean, you know, if Republicans are smart, they will come up with a better game plan other than just continue to move to push on the abortion issue. One of my favorite quotes, probably my very favorite quote in all of politics, is there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs. And for decades, Republicans have thought that, you know, undoing Roe versus Wade at the Supreme Court level, and to a lesser extent, what's that Casey case from the early 90s, Planned Parenthood, undoing those would be the big solution to undoing, you know, the sin of abortion in America. And okay, Roe versus Wade is no longer the law of the land. It was replaced by the precedent set by Dobbs v. Jackson. So here we are, and all of a sudden we've got this, you know, tidal wave of abortion legislation and abortion changes all over the country. And some of that means states are totally taking away abortion restrictions, and other states are really moving in for very, very stern abortion restrictions. And we've already seen in the 2023 elections that voters are moving toward, nope, we don't want to do this. We don't want to do strict abortion stuff. We want to move in favor of that. And the sooner Republicans start to understand that, the better it will be for Republicans nationwide. To Todd's point, how badly is that going to affect Iowa's legislative elections? Probably not as severely as Democrats want them or want it to. Probably not enough to, you know, flip either chamber, although, you know, I like to never say never in politics. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely a huge issue, and it's actually one where Trump has kind of split with the Republican Party and with Republican voters. Trump has been coming out and saying, yeah, we got to come up with some more reasonable stuff other than ban it outright at this stage or right at conception. The pro-life voters who are like, you know, life at conception, no exceptions, are they going to fall away from voting for Trump? No. That's not going to be enough to deter them.
I wanted to touch base with Liam. You know, you're the politics editor for the Daily Iowan, an award-winning student newspaper. You and some of your colleagues recently went to D.C. to talk with Iowa's congressional delegates. Can you tell me a little bit about the goal of this trip and what was one highlight?
Yeah, so luckily the Daily Iowan, every year we go on a reporting trip to D.C. to talk to our congressional delegation, thanks to a generous donation. Our main goal was to kind of talk to our congressional delegation about some of the main issues that kind of seemed pertinent at the time. So those involved the TikTok bill. We talked to Marionette Miller Meeks and Ashley Hinson about their lack of support for a motion to vacate the speakership, which, you know, has been very pertinent with the, you know, foreign aid supplements and the funding there. And then we also talked to them about issues like the border and asked them to kind of give us some of their solutions on said things and kind of look at it from more of a solutions journalism angle. We were able to get some, you know, answers on what they would support, including some reforms to legal immigration, but mostly reforms to security at the border at the moment.
Another Daily Iowan related question. These are two questions from the audience. The Daily Iowan recently bought two community newspapers in Mount Vernon and in Solon. I wondered if you could speak to how do you think this is going to affect practical journalism opportunities for students?
Yeah, so, you know, in addition to the Daily Iowan, where there's a lot of practical journalism applications and, you know, opportunities for students, there's, you know, now going to be, through the Daily Iowan, some opportunities to go work in local papers, the papers that kind of focus more on the local governments of the smallest towns in the state. Now, you know, Solon, Lisbon, Mount Vernon are some of the towns that will now be kind of covered in part by staff of the Daily Iowan, but mostly by student interns at the J School. So it'll be an interesting opportunity for a lot of students there to kind of get boots on the ground local government reporting and kind of local journalism that a lot of students won't be able to get until after college because of the nature of a lot of small newspapers being tight for cash right now.
Reproductive rights, abortion, certainly one of the top issues, according to polling nationwide in this coming election. Also the economy, inflation, immigration. I wonder, when we look at the congressional races in Iowa, no senators up for re-election in Iowa, U.S. senators this time around, but we do have, of course, our House members up for re-election. When you look at the four House members, which of those do you see as the most in danger of losing their seats, and how do you see that the campaign developing? We have Hinson and Marionette Miller-Meeks, Nunn, and Feenstra.
I'd say Zach Nunn's probably the most vulnerable. They say your second run is the most difficult. So that's when the minority party, or the party that doesn't hold the seat, usually picks off an incumbent as that first bid for re-election. I mean, Marionette Miller-Meeks, the political makeup of the district makes it a swing district, makes it actually lean a little Democratic, but I mean, she only won by 6 votes in her first election, but she won pretty handily against Christina Bohannon last time around, and that's who her opponent's going to be this time around. And I think Ashley Hinson's well established. I don't see much of a chance of knocking her off, especially in a year where you're conceivably going to have Trump voters surging to the polls to vote for their guy, and that usually is good news for Republicans in Iowa, given that he wins by 8 or 9, 10 percentage points.
Just to jump in there, to piggyback off of what Todd said, Marionette Miller-Meeks is going to have, I think, a tough re-election. You know, she's facing not only a challenge on the left, but she's also facing a challenge on the right. How competitive, how serious that challenge is, I guess, is debatable. You can question that. There's differing opinions as to, again, how competitive that primary challenge will be. But, the fact that she's facing a Republican challenger, means that she's going to have to spend some time and effort and some money, competing against that, fighting against that, as opposed to, for lack of a better term, saving your powder and, focusing on the general election and focusing on your Democratic opponent. But as Todd mentioned, she did handily win re-election this last time around, beating Christina Bohannon. However, Christina Bohannon this time around is getting a lot more support from national Democrats, from the campaign arm of congressional Democrats. So she's going to, and she also outraised Marionette Miller-Meeks in this most recent quarter. Granted, I think Marionette Miller-Meeks probably has more cash on hand. But you see that fundraising, you see the momentum, you see her raising more money than Miller-Meeks, and you see her being, listed on the DCCC's Red to Blue program, a top race that, House Democrats are going to target to try and flip Congress. And to me, that sends the message that she's probably going to have an easier time getting her message out there than she did last time around. And then, when you put the abortion politics into play, as we discussed, it could be really difficult for a Republican incumbent. We'll see how that plays out.
Question from the audience. If Marjorie Taylor Greene could get residence in Iowa, what are her chances of winning a congressional seat?
She'd be heavily favored in the 4th district, maybe.
To Todd's point, I think her chances are probably as good as Steve King's right now. I kind of view them in the same camp and kind of the same politics, right? And so, I think her chances are probably the same as Steve King getting reelected.
Althea, you slid down in your seat. What do you have to say about that?
I'm sorry. Every time I hear the name Marjorie Taylor Greene, I just have some sort of physical reaction. Apparently, when I'm sitting in this chair, sliding down in my seat and rolling my eyes, is it?
Adam, were you going to add anything?
No, just to Tom's point, I yearn for the old days of weirdo racist politics. The new era is even weirder to me compared to the Steve King era. I don't know.
I yearn for the era when Steve King was the worst thing we had to talk about.
and at least he put it out there, so we knew. Now it's like not...
He had the Confederate flag right on his desk.
Well, yeah. You didn't have to guess.
And he didn't have the power to take down the Speaker of the House unilaterally.
Well,
which is, you know.
Can you imagine?
Wow. We're going to take a break now to refresh our drinks and collect our thoughts, I guess. It's a special Pints and Politics edition of River to River, presented by the Gazette and IPR. Ben Kiefer with Aaron Jordan, my co-host. We'll be back with Tom Barton, Todd Dorman, Althea Cole, Adam Sullivan, Liam Hollowith, and a whole room full of political junkies. Back in just a moment. Okay, we're back with more of this special edition of River to River, Pints and Politics edition, presented by the Gazette and IPR. I'm Ben Kiefer with Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. Our panelists, Todd Dorman, Althea Cole, Adam Sullivan, Liam Hollowith of the Daily Iowan, and Tom Barton. I think I got everyone. We have a large panelist. Let's hear it for the panel.
Pass the thousands.
So we will, as Iowans, soon see changes in laws relating to taxes, education, mental health. Of course, we had the big debate and the passage of the overhaul of the state's area education agencies, tax cuts, religious freedom, immigration, lots of things there. But I wanted to focus on something I've been hearing a lot about, and I know Althea wrote a column about this to start us off here, permits to carry guns in schools. The law provides qualified immunity for school staff with permits to carry firearms and their employers from criminal and civil liability for damages pursuant to the application of reasonable force. Let's talk about this a little bit. Legal protections for arming school staff and that permitted in our schools. Althea, what are the points you wanted to make in your recent column?
What I wrote in my column, prevention is like a sieve. You know, if you can catch the bad stuff that you're intending to catch, great. If you don't, if it gets through the sieve, then you know there's no point. At that point, what you would need to do is intervene. Prevention is too late. So having armed security in the school is one method of intervention. But nobody is thinking that it's going to be the sole thing that prevents the entirety of the loss of lives. When I was going to church on Sunday, I ended up missing half the service. I walked in, and the person from the church safety team approached me, and he's like, "How's column writing going?" And we spoke about the column that I'd written that day. And he approached me from a standpoint of his interest in church shootings, because unfortunately, churches have, you know, realized the same awful reality that schools have, that armed, you know, intruders will do the same thing to church congregations that they will do to students. Again, truly evil things happen in this world. We wish we could prevent them, but let's be realistic. And so he's interested in qualified immunity in the event that defensive shooting has to take place at a church. But one thing he said to me really stood out. He said, there is a lawyer attached to every gun, and there is a lawsuit attached to every bullet. And qualified immunity wouldn't necessarily change that entirely. It would add more protection. But Ben, you quoted the part in the law that's very, very key here, in the application of reasonable force. So if the gun were to go off unexpectedly, that's not the application of reasonable force. That would not, you know, qualified immunity would not apply there. So what it is a way to intervene in the event that it already happens, when prevention is too late. And that's not to say that it's going to entirely stop a shooter. But when a shooter is involved in a firefight with armed security, those few precious seconds, or maybe even precious minutes, are not precious seconds and precious minutes where that shooter is shooting children. And that is the worst thing. That's what we don't want. And if school security can prevent that by having some sort of qualifying weapon on them, then it's not surprising to think that 65% of, you know, parents who participated in a recent Iowa poll back in, I think it was January or maybe even March of this year, after the shooting at Perry High School in Perry, said, yeah, we want to see armed security in schools.
Althea voiced what she expressed in her column. What else can be said there that perhaps is a different viewpoint? Todd, it looks like you
Well, I think it's going to whatever happens to this law is going to be more about insurance than ideology. You're already hearing about, you know, insurance companies, even with the qualified immunity, who are saying, no, we're not going to insure a school that has armed staff, other than, you know, trained police officers, perhaps, which some of the schools have, the, you know, the community outreach officers and people like that. But, and that's going to, I mean, that's tough. You have to have insurance. And I think that's going to be what comes down to make to the, as to the deciding factor. I think Des Moines already announced today that they were not going to participate. They're not going to allow their staff to be armed. You're going to see some schools do that. You'll probably see some schools try to arm their staff and then find out that, again, you know, insurance companies aren't going to cover them. And maybe that's not the best, most democratic system, but the reality is you got to have insurance, I guess.
Yeah, you also have gun violence prevention groups who point to other states that have passed similar measures and proposals and talk about that in the last, I think, 5 years, there have been more than 100 reported incidents of unsecured firearms in schools. You know, they talk about publicly reported incidents where, you know, either a teacher who's allowed to be armed because of that state law, or even a security officer or school resource officer has left a firearm in a locker room or a restroom. And, you know, they talk about, you know, so what happens in God forbid, the horrific situation that, you know, a kid gets their hands on the weapon. And yeah.
Another topic suggested by at least two in our audience, according to their questions here, something we've been talking about here in Iowa for several years, eminent domain and the carbon pipelines. Now, who on our panel is versed on this? Here are the questions. Of course, these are the proposed carbon pipelines to transport it across the state and sequester it, I think, in Illinois or the Dakotas, and crossing farmland, and the question of eminent domain. Here are the questions. Why does the Iowa Senate not vote on the eminent domain bill when the House sends it over to them? And the other questioner, yes or no, eminent domain will be used for a CO2 pipeline in Iowa in the next 2 years? If yes, will Iowa farmers still vote for Republicans? It's interesting here. Conservatives here, Iowa farmers, traditionally conservative, lining up with environmentalists against these carbon pipelines. What is the comment here from our panel?
Well, I think one thing is that I don't think Democrats have come out as strongly as they should against those carbon pipelines. I mean, you hear them strategize and say, how do we get an inroad into, you know, rural Iowa? How do we get some of those voters back that we've lost? And this would seem to be a sort of slam dunk issue. They could go out and say, we don't think your land should be taken for carbon pipelines that are basically going to make a small number of sort of land barons, ag barons, I don't know what you want to call them, the agrigentsia, going to make them very wealthy. I mean, we're talking about billions of tax incentives from the federal government. And Democrats have, I mean, I'm not saying all Democrats haven't opposed those strongly, using eminent domain, but it just hasn't, they haven't made it a defining issue, and I think that's been a mistake.
I think Democrats are conflicted over the issue because while you have the eminent domain question and the issue of property rights, you also have some Democrats who are supportive of unions and of the union jobs potentially that could be created through these carbon capture pipelines. And I believe that there have been a couple of unions who have, you know, come out in support of the projects and what this would do for supporting good-paying union jobs in Iowa. You also have the environmental aspect of it. You know, there are some who are a question or dispute, you know, the environmental value of these carbon capture pipelines. You have others who, you know, look to the Biden administration and the support for carbon capture technology to improve the environment and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So I think they're conflicted on the issue.
But the problem is, if you've got Democrats that say they want clean water, ethanol isn't clean water. I mean, you're overproducing corn to produce fuel. The more corn you produce, the more runoff, you know, nitrate-laden runoff you're going to have, and that's part of the problem. It is the problem in Iowa waterways. So, I mean, it's getting to the point where people have to realize if you're for clean water, which a lot of Democrats say they are, then, you know, it's time to stop using government, you know, programs to prop up ethanol if it can't stand on its own.
No, I just think it's these pipeline issues especially are fascinating because, like, you have, I think as the question alluded to, you have these pretty conservative people who, like, right in their backyards, they get really caught up in, like, a property rights issue that, like, sets off, like, really base libertarian instincts of, like, no, this is my land and you can't do that. Like, and, like, even though that in a bigger picture, it is somewhat in service to big ag and traditional energy sources, which they support. They're like, no, this is my property.
Since Todd hit on nitrate-laden water, I feel like I need to ask these two questions from the audience. They mentioned some of the reporting that's been done about cancer rates, Iowa being number two in the nation for cancer diagnoses and having the fastest growing cancer rate. And the question of whether anyone in the legislature is going to react to this, ask for more research, do anything related to these cancer rates?
So, Democrats in the legislature, made this a focal point during floor debate on the HHS budget, Health and Human Services budget, and, you know, essentially kind of poise those similar questions to Republican leadership in both the House and the Senate, asking, you know, what are you going to do to address this issue? And I wasn't in the Senate, but at least in the House, the response during the floor debate from the bill's floor manager, Joel Fly, a Republican from Osceola, is that, you know, there is federal grant funding coming into Iowa, coming to the University of Iowa, research grants to do a lot of research into cancer, saying that they support that. And then also talking about passage of legislation this session it's always iffy when I try and weigh into medical terms and trying to describe something, but they passed legislation related to biomarkers and insurance coverage for biomarkers and being able to get coverage more effective cancer treatment and clinical trials, so forth. So at least from the Republican side, you know, they argue that they're trying to address this from the insurance side of things and you know, relying on the research that's being done at Iowa's universities. Democrats argue that the state should be actively and I guess maybe more aggressively funding and putting money toward the issue of cancer and you know, funding research and doing things through state health agencies to address that issue.
What do you think of the bill passed by the House and Senate that would limit the potency of consumable hemp products to 4 milligrams of THC per serving and 10 per container?
I think that's not ideal. It's not what I would have done. I would not have capped anything. I think they changed it to 21 to buy when there previously was maybe no age limit, or eight. I would have kept it at 18 or something. Like, that seems fine. But, like, I thought that recent status quo where you could just walk into bars and buy weed drinks, I thought that was fine. I think you can even buy them here maybe. So I don't think they needed to do that. But in the bigger picture, I think it's, like, I'm pleasantly surprised that that we are where we are, that you can buy these products right now in the red state of Iowa. Like the, I think when they passed the hemp bill like 5 years ago, I think they've kind of admitted now they didn't know what they were getting into with this. So the fact that they didn't like swing way back the other way and like try to ban them or try to like really cut down on them, like my understanding is like a 10 milligram for a recreational user, that's like probably like that's a dose. And so like, that's fine. I mean, it's not the best. They should have just left it alone because it was fine already. But I think it's a great sign that like we're winning on this issue, that all of my columns really made a difference. And the Republicans, they get it now.
Climbing Kites is for sale right up there at the front of the front of this establishment. So not that I'm condoning or endorsing.
All right. Well, last time we met, we did kind of an experiment and tried kind of a lightning fill-in-the-blank speed round at the end of the program. And we decided we wanted to try it again. The panel's going to work together to see how many of these they can get right. And so, you know, be ready to jump in there, panel. Are you guys ready? Are you excited?
No. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, here we go, the lightning round.
They look excited.
And you know, you out there, you answer them for yourselves. You might say afterwards, well, I could be a panelist. These guys, they don't know that much.
Great. All right.
Okay, so here's the bell. So the bell means it's right, right?
Right, exactly. All right, the first one. What big tech company would get $56 million in local tax breaks to build a data center in Cedar Rapids?
Google.
Let me Google that quick. I'm not sure.
Okay. What did Republican Texas Congressman Tony Gonzalez call some of his fellow Republican members of Congress he serves with?
Lunatics.
A little harsher than that. Scumbags is right out in the audience. He said... I serve with some real scumbags on CNN, and then he named Matt Gaetz. According to the Borowitz Report headline this week, millions cancel subscriptions to National Enquirer after learning what? Its stories may not be true.
We're going to wrap up for tonight. I want to thank our panelists, Todd Dorman, Tom Barton, Althea Cole from the Gazette, and our special guests, Adam Sullivan and Liam Hallowith. Don't forget to join us June 6th at Millstream Brewing in Amana. Thanks to Big Grove, and have a great night.
Thanks, everybody.
And that concludes highlights from Pints and Politics, recorded yesterday evening, April 25th at Big Grove in Cedar Rapids. Find out how you can attend future Pints and Politics events at thegazette.com. Our producer and audio editor today, Danny Gear. Sound engineer, Jim Davies. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Not a Gazette subscriber? There's no better time to support local journalism. View our latest deals for print and digital offerings at thegazette.com/subscribe. Stay informed, be empowered. Subscribe to The Gazette today at thegazette.com/subscribe.